welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is Understanding the WebSphere MQ Java Message Service Classes. Today's presenter is Justin Fries. Justin joined WebSphere MQ Level 2 service in 1997 and helped to establish the new WebSphere Service Integration Bus Service Team in 2004. He has supported both products since their earliest days, with particular focus on the Java Message Service Interface and Unix and Linux systems. In addition to supporting customers, he works with development to improve serviceability and provides education to other service team members. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Justin.
Thank you very much, Joseph, and good morning, everyone. My name is Justin Fries, and this morning we will be discussing the WebSphere MQ Java Message Service classes. If you can go to foil 2, Joseph. This morning we will start by talking about the Java Message Service or JMS classes generically. The first half of the presentation should be applicable to any JMS provider, not just IBM WebSphere MQ or other IBM providers. We'll talk about the application interfaces provided by JMS. We're going to talk about JMS messages and their properties. And we'll also talk about some issues relating to portability if you wish to move an application between JMS providers. The second half of the presentation is going to focus on enhancements made by WebSphere MQ version 7 to the JMS classes and to the product itself to support JMS. So we will talk a little bit about how the JMS classes were implemented in version 6 and prior releases, and then we will talk about the new changes that are designed to make JMS an even better fit for WebSphere MQ. Included in that will be a new packaging for the MQJMS classes, and a bit of a re-architecture or restructuring of those classes. We will talk about new enhancements for JMS message properties and also for selecting messages based on those properties. We'll talk about shared connections, network connections to a queue manager, asynchronous delivery of messages, and also the new native publish-subscribe feature that's part of WebSphere MQ version 7. Let's move on to slide 3. First, the Java Message Service, or JMS, is a generic programming interface for messaging. As I'm sure most of you are probably quite familiar, it allows you to do both point-to-point and publish-subscribe messaging. It's an interface that's supported by many, probably dozens of different messaging providers, and it's an integral part of Java Enterprise Edition, or Java EE, formerly was known as J2 EE. The specification for JMS is freely available online at the URL given on the page. Let's move on to slide 4 to talk a little bit more about the specification. There are two main versions of the JMS spec. There are some previous ones that really don't much matter these days. These are the ones that are available on the website. First is JMS version 1.0.2b. which is from August 2001, or about that time frame. This is the spec that describes most of the JMS features that we use and support today. It's divided messaging into two different domains. There were interfaces to do point-to-point messaging, and there were separate interfaces to do publish-subscribe messaging, but they were kept separate. In the next version of the spec, JMS 1.1 from 2002, those two domains were merged into a single common domain, a single set of interfaces that would let programmers do both publish-subscribe and point-to-point messaging all at once. I think it'd probably be fair to say that the initial division between the two domains was not a good idea, and JMS 1.1 rectified that. Let's move now to slide 5. Here are the most important interfaces, I suppose, of the JMS specification. On the left-hand column, I'm showing the JMS 1.1 interfaces. These are the new interfaces that allow you to do both types of messaging at once in an application. The two columns on the right show the older interfaces that were specifically tied to point-to-point and pub-sub messaging. If you're running new applications, I think today there's very little reason to use the older interfaces. And there are a number of good reasons to use the new interfaces. Most importantly, even if you start off writing an application and you only plan to work with queues and could get away with using the queue-type interfaces, you may find at some point you're asked to extend your application to do PubSub as well. If you've used the JMS 1.1 interfaces, that will be easy to do. So now let's talk a little bit about each of these interfaces, just enough to get our feet wet. For those of you who have been doing a lot of JMS programming for a long time, well, if you want to get a coffee at this point, you can, or you can listen carefully and grill me in the Q&A if I make any mistakes. But let's go to foil number 6. The first interface to talk about is the Connection Factory interface. A Connection Factory object stores details on how to contact a JMS provider. For example, in the case of WebSphere MQ, a Connection Factory would contain the name of the queue manager to which you wish to connect, the method you wanted to connect using, for example, a client connection or a local connection. If you were doing a client connection, you have to give a host name and a port and a channel name, a number of other details. All of that information is held in the Connection Factory object. For other JMS providers, there are different details that these objects will hold. For example, if you use the Service Integration Bus, your Connection Factory is at least going to contain a bus name. It may also contain some details about what messaging engine you wish to contact. Well, now let's go on. Using the Connection Factory, whatever details it contains, there's a method on the Connection Factory called createConnection, which will use those parameters to create the second object type I've listed, a connection object. A connection represents a physical connection to the JMS provider. In many cases, this probably can be thought of as a TCP/IP connection, although that's not necessarily required. Every connection in JMS is required to support multiple use, so multiple threads can use a single JMS connection at the same time. With a JMS connection, one can call a method called createSession to create the object shown on the next foil, foil number 7, and that is a session object. Session objects are an independent context for doing messaging activity. Every session, the work done in a session, can be associated with a transaction. So if you have two sessions, then potentially you have two separate transactions, and the work going on in each session will be tied with its own transaction. This is where most of the work happens. Typically, a JMS application, after getting a connection, it'll create a session, and then the connection is not really used for very much. All the work is done within the session itself. Now, inside a session, a JMS application can work with a destination or a queue or a topic object. These objects store details of the JMS provider's queue or topic. You can create, for example, a queue object that refers to the system.default.local.queue on a particular queue manager, or a topic object that refers to a topic of your choosing. Inside a session, a JMS application will use these three destination objects, or destination queues and topics, to create the object on foil 8. Message producer objects. A message producer is an object that can send messages to a destination, to a topic, or to a queue. If you have used the JMS 1.0 classes, there's something similar to a message producer called a queue sender. A queue sender, however, is limited only to sending messages to a queue. Similarly, there is a topic publisher class, which can only publish to a topic. So if you do need to use those interfaces, they are described in the documentation, both the JMS spec and the WebSphere MQ documentation, but the message producer class can do both types of messaging. Similarly, one can create a message consumer object which will retrieve messages from a destination, from a topic, or from a queue. And now we turn to the messages themselves. A message is an object in JMS. It contains a header with some required properties that all JMS providers must support. And the header, there's also a series of optional properties which the JMS provider may add some of its own, or the application can add some of its own properties. And every message, the body of the message, the payload, will follow one of five different formats, which would begin on page 9. The first type of JMS message is a text message. This is probably the most common type, I think. the one I see most often, the body of the message is a single Java string. Very commonly, we see this type of message used for XML payloads. Text message, by the way, the names that I'm giving here are actually subclasses of the message object or message type. So every message is a message, but in addition, every message will be either a text message or a bytes message or the other object types I'm listing here. Second comes a bytes message object. This is a type of JMS message where the payload is just a bunch of bytes. It's uninterpreted. It can contain any data at all. Opaque, I think, is a good word to describe these messages. The third type of message is an object message. JMS allows one to take a Java object and to write it into a message. The object being written has to be serializable. So it's possible to take an object, bundle it into a message, send it off to somebody else, and they can read that object out of the message. Object messages are a little bit tricky, though. It's important to make sure that the classes implementing whatever object you're sending are available at the recipient's location. Otherwise, it's possible to get a object message and the receiver can't read the object out because they get a no class def found error. So a little bit tricky at times. FOIL 10 gives the final two message types. First, a map message. The body of a map message contains a bunch of name value pairs. Each name is a string, and each value is a Java primitive. The convenience of a map message is that one can access, read, update the values in a map message using that string name. So it's not required that one sequentially access the fields in a map message. On the other hand, a stream message just contains a group of Java primitive values. There are no names associated with them. So in a stream message, Java primitives are written into the message body serially, and they're read serially out of the message body. Let's go on to FOIL number 11 and talk a little bit about the message header. JMS requires that the following fields be available in the message header. First come the message ID and correlation ID. For those of you who have been using MQ for a long time, they should be very familiar fields. Message ID is required to be unique by JMS. Correlation ID is usually used to map up a request with a reply message. There's JMS delivery mode, which basically works out to persistent or non-persistent messages. There's JMS priority, which, like MQ, has values from 0 through 9, lowest to highest. JMS destination describes where the message is being sent to. And if the message expects replies, the JMS reply to field will indicate where reply messages should be sent. JMS timestamp records when the message was sent, in GMT, I believe. And JMS expiration, optionally, the field must be provided, but it can be filled in to indicate that the message should expire at some point in the future. JMS redelivered is a field that indicates whether a message has attempted delivery more than once. For example, a message may be delivered, the application receiving it fails, and the message gets rolled back. On the next delivery attempt, that will be set to indicate that it's being redelivered. And finally, the JMS type field is used to indicate what kind of message are we dealing with, a text, object, bytes, map, or stream JMS message. Let's go on to FOIL number 12. Optional properties that are supported by JMS messages follow three different flavors. First, the JMS specification itself has added some optional properties. These all begin with the name JMSX. For example, JMSX user ID and JMSX Apple ID give the identity of the user and of the application that sent a message. JMSX delivery count can indicate how many times a message was attempted for delivery. And there are several others listed in the specification. Second, the JMS provider, like WebSphere MQ, can set its own properties. And these, no matter who you're dealing with, the format required by the spec for the property names is JMS_vendor_. So for IBM, our properties are JMS_IBM_, such as the JMS-IBM format and the JMS-IBM character set. These properties allow JMS applications to access fields within the underlying MQ message. And finally, applications can set their own message properties. You can go pretty crazy with this if you want. The only requirement is that your property names not begin with the letters JMS. Let's continue on to slide 13. So JMS properties, the values stored by these properties are Java primitives or the corresponding object types. For example, an int or an int object, a Boolean or a Boolean object, floats, longs, strings. Null values are also allowed for the value of a particular property. And the great use of these properties is that an application can select messages and retrieve messages based on their properties. It's almost a little bit like selecting information out of a database table. In this case, you're perhaps consuming messages from a queue, and you select only those messages which you want. And the syntax for doing this is a little bit like SQL syntax as well. In fact, it is a subset. For example, you can get a message where price is greater than 300 and fabric equals wool. Why not? Selectors only work on these properties. They do not work on the message body, not even for map messages, which the body of the message is just looks like a bunch more properties, but it's considered part of the body and not used for selection. Slide 14. Let's talk a little bit about portability of JMS applications. If they're written properly, a JMS application can be entirely portable from one provider to another. For example, you could write a JMS application which uses WebSphere MQ as the provider. And perhaps you install, say, WebSphere version 7, and you decide you want to use the service integration bus included in WebSphere as your provider instead. If you've done it right, you shouldn't have to change your application in the least. Some advice for making that happen: first, be quite careful when importing classes into your application that you're importing only the generic interface classes, not the provider-specific ones. So, for example, in red, I've given an example of something that's not portable, an import for some SIB-specific classes. Below it in green, import javax.jms.star, that is portable. Use interface, not implementation object types. So, for example, in red, here's a programmer using an MQ connection factory, which is specific, of course, to MQ only and will not work with other providers. On the other hand, see the line in green says connection, con equals cf.createConnection. It doesn't read MQ connection equals cf.createConnection because we're trying to use generic object types. And lastly, avoid provider-specific features and extensions if you wish your application to be portable. Now, not all applications necessarily have to be portable. It really comes down to what you want for your application, if you need that flexibility. If we go to slide 15, there is an obstacle, an apparently significant one, to portability in JMS applications. When I talked earlier about JMS Connection Factory and destination, queue, topic, objects, I mentioned that they contain details about how to connect to a JMS provider or where a queue is located in a provider. Though necessarily, that's provider-specific information. So how on earth does one write a program that's going to be portable? For example, here is some code from an MQ JMS application. Right off the bat, you can see that it imports com.ibm.mq.jms.star. So we're importing MQ-specific classes. Next, it creates an MQ connection factory object. And the next five lines, the JMS application is calling MQ-specific methods to fill in the connection properties for that factory. It's creating a factory that uses a client mode of connection to a queue manager called justin.qmgr on the host posana.ibm.com, using the channel jms.servercon on port 1423. All very useful and necessary and not at all portable. Next, we have an MQQ called test.q. And this particular application is setting a attribute called target client, indicating that this queue will send messages to a non-JMS MQ application. So if these fields, if these objects are required to store provider-specific properties, how on earth can we ever write a portable application? And slide 16 will give the solution to this. JMS connection factory and destination objects are serializable, and this means that they can be created in advance outside the application by an administrator. The most efficient place to do so, if you're running inside WebSphere application server, you can use the WebSphere console, go under Resources, JMS, and you can create these objects in advance. It has a very pretty panel in which you can fill in all the attributes. WebSphere MQ also allows one to create JMS objects. Using the WebSphere MQ Explorer, just look under JMS Administered Objects, and you can do this. Third, I provided a link to a web item I wrote up several years ago that's still quite applicable today, which shows how to use the WebSphere console or the MQ Explorer, or shows how to create objects using the WS Admin scripting tool, the JMS Admin command line tool. There's several different ways that you can create these JMS objects. So if you're curious about that, I encourage you to follow that link. Now, these objects, once created by the administrator, are stored in JNDI, the Java Naming Directory Interface. So they're in some place where they can be looked up by the JMS application while it is running. And on slide 17, I show how to do that. This code would be appropriate inside an application server. It may look a little bit different depending on where your JMS application is running. In essence, we have to add a new import. We have to import javax.naming.star to our application. And those naming classes allow us to look up JMS objects. For example, we have JNDI equals new initial context. A context allows us to access a JNDI directory. The second line of code says JNDI.lookup, java:comp/env/jms/myconfactory. That's the name of the JMS object inside our directory store, and this code allows the JMS app to look up its connection factory. Similarly, the next line looks up a queue object. Now, the type of those objects, whether those are MQ connection factories and queues, or SI bus connection factories or queues, or Sonic MQ message or connection factories or queues, is unknown at this point. That's entirely up to the administrator who stored the things in the first place. In this example, the only hard-coded values left are those JNDI lookup names, java:comp/env and the rest of it. Those names, following that specific format, are special. In an application server, an administrator can remap those when deploying an application. So even if the names aren't quite what the administrator would want, he or she can point them to the right object. Let's go on to slide 18. I assure you I will not read every line in this, but this is a sample JMS application. At the beginning, we have our imports, the Java or JMS import and the naming import. The naming import gets used by the next group of four lines where we look up a connection factory in a queue. And then following that, we begin to go through the interfaces I mentioned before. First, we use our connection factory to create a connection. Next, we start the connection, which means that we can now receive messages from it. The next line, we use that connection to create a session. And the arguments on the right, the true and session.autoacknowledge, the true flag means that this is a transacted session. So the work we're doing is going to be part of a transaction. Next, we create a message consumer on the queue mentioned above. And this particular message consumer does use a selector. It's selecting on a property called movie, where the movie value begins with STAR. So potentially you could look up any messages where the movie property might be Star Trek or Star Wars or Starman or anything like that. Next, we receive a message, and I'm assuming that we're receiving a text message. In a real JMS application, by the way, there would have to be try, catch blocks, and the rest of it. I've left that out for what I hope is added clarity. Finally, we're going to print out some details about the message. First, we'll print out the string property movie. What was the value? Did we look up a Star Trek or a Star Wars movie? And then the next line prints out the body of the message. After doing so, we commit the work in that session so the message is truly removed from the queue. And then since we're done, we can just close the entire connection and everything else goes away for us. So that's the basic idea of a JMS application. Let's go on to slide 19. JMS and Java Enterprise Edition, Java EE. Java Enterprise Edition, since J2EE 1.4, has required that a JMS provider be available. In WebSphere Application Server, initially that was WebSphere MQ as the JMS provider. More recently, it's the service integration bus. Inside an application server in a Java EE environment, there are some changes to the JMS semantics, which can be a little surprising if you're not anticipating them. First, in some containers like the EJB and Web Container, you can only have one JMS session within a JMS connection. You can't create multiple sessions. Secondly, the EJB container will ignore some of the arguments, in fact, all of the arguments, to the create session method. In the previous example program, I mentioned that we were using a transacted session. We had passed a true as the argument to create session. EJB would ignore that because it's going to manage the transactions itself. Lastly, there are some methods that are disallowed in an application server environment. Connection.stop, for example. There's an interface called setMessageListener, which is disallowed. So it may seem odd that we're disallowing some things in Java EE. It might almost sound, if you're not sure, like we're hobbling this JMS specification. But if we go into slide 20, we do get some nice things in Java EE, specifically Java JMS message-driven beans. A message-driven bean is a bean that's quite simple. It contains one little method, which I've noted on the bottom, called onMessage. And the onMessage method just has to have the code for handling that message. For example, in this case, it prints out the text of a message. Real-life MDBs are probably a bit more complicated. They may insert the message into a database or something else like that. But the advantage of MDBs is that a JMS application only has to fill in that one method. The details of actually connecting to the JMS provider, getting a session, opening the queue or the topic, and getting messages is left up to the application server itself. And that's a great simplification. Let's go on to foil number 21. In WebSphere Application Server, historically, WebSphere has used something called a listener port to deliver messages to message-driven beans. Listener ports are configured by the administrator in the console, and I've given the path there. Every listener port object has a connection factory and a destination from which it will connect and get the messages. So when an MDB application is deployed to WebSphere, the listener port will start, will connect, and will watch for messages. As it finds messages that match any selectors given by the MDB, it will instantiate the MDB and kick off that onMessage method. And it is possible to configure a listener port to run multiple copies of an MDB in parallel. You can say, I want as many as 10 of these things going at one time. So you can get quite a lot of parallelism and improve your performance there. Let's go on to slide 22, which brings us to the second half of the presentation. So having talked about JMS in generic and with some references to WebSphere and WebSphere MQ, I suppose, we're now going to focus almost entirely on WebSphere MQ version 7 and some of the changes it adds to improve JMS support. Foil 23, please. Well, the WebSphere MQ has supported JMS for quite a long time. I can't remember exactly, but I think it was about 1998 or thereabouts that we first offered any JMS classes at all. Initially, the JMS classes were in a support pack called MA88, which was a free download. And at that point, of course, there was no JMS 1.1. This is purely JMS 1.0 classes. WebSphere MQ 5.3, which is at this point two releases back, included JMS 1.0 classes with the product. That was back in about 2002. And in maintenance, we updated those classes to support JMS 1.1. That would be, I think, about 2002 or 2003, somewhere in there, maybe 2004. And then finally, in CSD 8, we updated WebSphere MQ 5.3 to include a publish subscribe broker. Previously in MQ, if you wanted to do PubSub, you had to download a support pack called MA0C. Or alternatively, you could run a product like MQ Integrator or MQ Event Broker or MQ Message Broker. Going to slide 24, here are some of the recent developments with WebSphere MQ JMS support. In 2007, WebSphere MQ version 6 updated the packaging of the MQ JMS classes. We began to ship a resource adapter, jar file, or a RAR file, and I'll speak to that a little bit more later. And finally, WebSphere MQ version 7, which was released last year, has a number of changes. Re-architected the classes and refactored them somewhat. We added support in the queue manager for some JMS APIs, things that had to be emulated before. We made topics real objects. Previously, they were just queue objects and a PubSub broker. And finally, we integrated a new high-performance PubSub broker into WebSphere MQ. So the broker that's now available in version 7 is no longer based on the old MA0C support pack. Full 25, please. So here's the packaging, historically, of MQ. We've shipped two files, com.ibm.mqjms.jar, via JMS classes. And those classes depended on com.ibm.mq.jar. WebSphere Application Server also ships these files all the way up through version 6.1. And inside WebSphere Application Server, there is a variable called mq install root, which gives the location of these files. You can update that variable in the admin console if you wish. For example, if you install a newer version of MQ and wish to use the newer JMS classes, you can do so. The version of the MQ JMS classes shipped at many different levels of WebSphere is available at that web link I've given. Now, the only problem with this packaging is that installing these JMS files in other application servers was iffy at best, unsupported in many cases. I know we did support certain web logic levels, but otherwise it was not universally supported. So let's move on to foil number 26. Now, in WebSphere MQ 6021 and version 7 and later, we continue to ship the JMS jar files as we did before, but we now ship a JCA, or Java Connector Architecture, resource adapter. And what does that mean? It means that we now have a file called wmq.jmsra.rar, which contains the JMS classes and some other glue inside there. And those, a RAR file, can be installed into any application server that is J2EE compliant. So, I mean, there are dozens of applications servers out there, proprietary ones, open source ones. In theory, you should now be able to use the MQJMS classes and install them easily into any of them. WebSphere Application Server version 7 does not ship the old .jar files anymore. Instead, it only uses the resource adapter file. And then by curious chance, WebSphere Application Server at older levels, version 6 and 6.1, they are actually unable to use the RAR file due to some conflicts with code that's already there. So if you're using WebSphere version 6 or 6.1, you're going to need to continue with the jar files. If you need to use the resource adapter, then WebSphere version 7 will provide that. Poll number 27, please. Java Connector Architecture Activation Specifications, or ACT specs. These are new objects that are similar to listener ports in their function. An activation specification has a connection factory and a destination, just like a listener port. And they drive message-driven beams just like listener ports. They're very much like listener ports, except that they are required now by the EJB 3.0 spec. And previous EJB specifications also used them. What this means is that if you have applications in WebSphere, MDBs, that are using listener ports, at some point you're going to have to switch over to using activation specifications. Activation specifications only work with things that are packaged in a resource adapter file. So this new RAR file packaging for MQ is quite important for future development of message-driven beams. If the spec requires that you do an activation spec for your message-driven beam, then you're going to have to use the MQ RAR file packaging. In WebSphere Application Server, there is a migration wizard available in the console which can migrate your listener ports to activation specifications. you're on to Folder 28. And talk a little bit about how the MQJMS classes were architected originally. Before the MQJMS classes came out, there were available for MQ what we call the base Java classes. And these are classes that allow you to connect to MQ and do messaging. However, it's not the JMS interface. The interface given is much more like the MQ C++ interface classes. You can do pretty much anything you wish in the MQI, the message queue interface, using those base classes, which are available in com.ibm.mq.jar. So those came out first. And when developing the MQJMS classes, the development said, well, let's build them on top of the base Java classes. So every feature in JMS had to be implemented using features of the message queue interface. Some concepts fit quite naturally, others less so. So the MQJMS classes were built on top of the base Java classes. Let's go on to Folder 29, which shows how that worked. At the top, we have the MQJMS classes, underneath them the base Java classes, which provided two methods of connecting to MQ. The base classes could connect as an MQ client over the network, or they could use some native code called the bindings library to connect to a local queue manager. Now, because the base Java classes did not contemplate everything JMS wanted to do, the JMS classes had to emulate a lot of features, which meant that they were comparatively large, complex, and at times even a bit subtle. If we move on to Folder 30, we'll talk about how that's been changed for WebSphere MQ version 7. What has happened is that we've expanded the message queue interface, the MQI. So queue managers themselves now understand a lot more different ways of interacting. The MQI increased from 13 to either 26 or 27 verbs, depending on how you're counting. So there's a lot more than just MQ get, MQ put, and so forth. So we have a new package now, which interacts with this expanded MQI. And in version 7, it's com.ibm.mqi.jmqi.jar. And that package supports access to all those verbs over client mode and also bindings mode for local queue managers. Now, both the MQJMS classes and the MQBase Java classes now use that interface. So the JMS classes no longer sit on top of the base Java classes, as Folder 31 shows. Here we see the base Java classes and the JMS classes talking through the Java message queue interface to the queue manager. The classes are quite a lot thinner because MQ itself now knows how to do a lot of things that previously were somewhat foreign concepts to it. We'll get into some of those shortly. Now let's go on to flow number 32. MQJMS message properties. If you've worked with WebSphere MQ itself, you know that every message inside MQ has a message descriptor called an MQMD. The MQMD is fixed and not easily extended. Since the product's been out since, about 1992, we've had exactly two versions, if I have that right, of the MQMD. So expanding it for new fields is not an easy thing to do. And you cannot add arbitrary fields to an MQMD. So how to support JMS? Well, when we decided to implement JMS support for MQ, we added a new header called a MQ Rules and Formatter Header Version 2, or RFH2 header. An RFH2 header is used to hold all those JMS message properties that just have no home in an MQ message descriptor. There's no place to put them. It's a variable length structure. It contains XML code, so it can be extended to contain custom properties, properties set by applications, and so forth. It's a very, very flexible sort of thing. So let's go on to slide 33. This slide shows a message browsed off of an MQQ, a JMS message. It shows the message descriptor at the top, and I have not shown all the fields because it's not so large a slide, and I didn't want to use a tiny font, but I'm listing some of the fields in the message descriptor that are important to JMS. On the second line of that message descriptor, you can see that in MQ, the format of the message is it's an RFH2 message, as far as the queue manager is concerned. And if we look in the body of the message, which is in black there, we have this structure beginning with the eyecatcher RFH, which is our RFH2 header. This is the thing that's going to contain all of those optional properties. Inside the RFH2 header, I've listed in bold several fields. One says JMS underscore text. This corresponds to the JMS type field, indicates what type of payload we're dealing with, the text message. I also have some user properties here. I have a property called composer, and the composer property has a name of Mendelssohn. So if one wanted to, one could select messages from a queue where composer equals Mendelssohn, if you wished. And then finally, in red, following the RFH2 header, we have the actual body of the message. In this case, happy birthday, Felix. Felix Mendelssohn's 200th birthday this year, so if you're wondering why. Let's go on to foil 34. In WebSphere MQ JMS, any message sitting on an MQ queue with a message descriptor and an RFH2 header will be received as a JMS message. Any message actually on an MQ queue, even without an RFH2 header, will also be received as a JMS message if you're using JMS classes, but they're going to be missing some important details because that RFH header is crucial. Any message sent by the MQ JMS classes will in MQ have an MQ message descriptor and the RFH2 header. And the RFH2 header is just key. Without that header, we're not going to be able to store all of the properties required for a JMS message. However, it is possible to suppress that header in one case. If you're writing a JMS application, sending messages to a queue, and those messages are going to be read by an existing MQ, native MQ application, that native application may have no concept of RFH2 headers and not know what to do with them. So it is possible to request that the RFH2 header not be generated, specifically not to confuse older programs. Let's go on to slide 35. So how has version 7 changed things for these message properties? Well, some things are the same. We still have an MQMD, and we still use the RFH2 header. However, we now have interfaces that native MQ applications can access the RFH2 header properties. Not just access them, a native MQ app can now add properties, query their values, modify them, delete them, whatever it wants. And before, if you wanted to do this in a native MQ application, you would have to, by hand, very carefully manipulate the RFH2 header. So you might have to be conscious of how to parse and generate XML, and not an easy thing to do. Second, an MQ JMS or an MQ native application, when it receives a message, even if that message had an RFH2 header, the application can now control whether or not it will receive the RFH2 header in the body of the message or not. So it's possible to have a message with an RFH2 header, and if your program doesn't want to see it, it need not do so. There's an attribute on queues now called PropCTL, which controls how should these message properties be handled. Should they be in an RFH2 header in the body of the message, or should they be handled elsewhere? Now, similarly, the MQJMS classes have been extended as well. They could always access the RFH2 header fields, but they didn't have full access to everything in the message descriptor, and that has now changed. All of the MQMD fields now have properties which a JMS application can use. One problem that some people had, too, with the previous versions of the JMS classes is that they always generated an RFH2 header and plunked it onto the front of the message. Some people wanted to be able to write a JMS application that would carefully custom craft an MQ message, maybe of a particular format, like an IMS or a Kix bridge message, and send it up to the mainframe. Well, that was impossible because the JMS classes always interpose that RFH2 header. It's now possible to control whether that happens. So the effect now is that native MQ applications can easily work with JMS message properties. It's not a foreign language to them anymore. And JMS applications can much more easily work with native MQ properties. So everybody can talk to everybody else a lot more nicely. Let's go now to foil number 36. Message selection in version 6 and older versions of MQ. Well, I mentioned earlier that JMS allows one to write an application that will select a message based on properties. For example, quantity less than 5 or in stock equals false. However, MQQ managers have really only supported two types of pattern matching. One can match on message ID and or correlation ID, and that's pretty much it. Well, there was also something called group ID, but that wasn't frequently used. So how on earth do we make this work? How can we do selection on properties when the queue manager doesn't support that? And the answer was, if an MQJMS application wanted to select on properties, the JMS classes provided by MQ had to browse through the messages on the queue, which means the queue manager would send a message down. The JMS code, the MQ code, would look at that message and evaluate whether it matched. And if it matched, it would give it to the application. And if it didn't match, it would say, right, browse me another one. Let me take a look at the next one. So that could be very, very slow. Imagine if you have a queue with 100,000 messages on it, and you're looking for that one message that matches your criteria. That could be 99,000 browses before you finally get the message you want. Let's go on to slide 37 to see how it's done in version 7 of MQ. In version 7, matching on property fields is now integrated into the queue manager proper. So a client which wants specific messages no longer has to have MQJMS classes doing a bunch of browsing for them. Instead, the MQJMS classes will send the selector string up to the queue manager, which will evaluate it locally. So the performance can just be orders of magnitude faster depending on your scenario or the depth of your queues. Not only JMS applications, but native MQ applications can also take advantage of this. There is a selection string that can be passed to MQ Open or to the new MQ Sub verb, which is used to subscribe to a topic. So using this selection string, the queue manager can again do matching for native MQ applications as well. Let's go to slide 38. Connections and sessions. I mentioned at the very beginning of this presentation that JMS allows applications to create more than one session within a JMS connection. However, MQ didn't really support that as such. WebSphere MQ, a client or a network connection, really only allows one user at a time. So the first connection to MQ would get a network connection, and the first session could use it. But any subsequent sessions that were created required MQ to create a separate network connection to the queue manager. And those extra network connections added some additional overhead. But even worse, if one had something like a load balancer, it's possible that two sessions in the JMS connection could get routed to two different places because they're not sharing the same network connection. And that really doesn't work at all. It's not something I think we saw very frequently, or actually I don't think I've ever run across it, but at least theoretically, this could be trouble. So let's go to slide 39. WebSphere MQ version 7 adds the ability for connections to be shared. That is, multiple clients can now use a single TCP/IP connection. I should say multiple clients in a single process. You can't have two separate programs, you know, using the same connection, but inside for something like an application server or even a standalone JVM, you can create one JMS connection, which will be one MQ network connection. You can create one session, which will still stay within that network connection. You can create a second or a third or a fourth session. All of those will share the same network connection. So you're guaranteed then that your sessions are all going to the same place as you would expect. There's another advantage of this. Connection loss is now much better. Well, first of all, if there's any trouble with the connection, the network connection, all of the sessions will lose their connectivity at once, rather than maybe some still sort of working, others not working anymore. But there's another feature of this. In order to support multiple sessions sharing a single connection, we now have a little thread there that manages that connection and is able to talk back and forth with the queue manager and detect much more quickly if the connection has dropped, especially when a connection drops silently. the connection fails in a bad way. Normally there are all sorts of reset packets flowing around the network and everybody gets the idea, but detecting a silent connection loss where somebody's pulled out a cable or a firewall, has somebody's kicked the power cord on it, that's a nice feature to be able to have. Now, MQI applications, native MQ apps, can use this feature as well. There's a new attribute on ServerCon channels called ShareConv or ShareConversation. By default, an application can have as many as 10 connections up to MQ over a single network connection. Let's go to slide 40. Asynchronous delivery of messages. JMS allows one to write an application that will receive messages without explicitly sitting there and waiting and waiting and waiting for them. That's done using message-driven beams inside an application server. So in the most modern incarnation, it means that you've created a JMS a JCA activation spec, or if you have an older version of WebSphere, a listen report, and you've deployed an MDB application against that. Even outside Java Enterprise Edition, you can actually do this. There is a set message listener interface you can use in a standalone Java server, which can allow messages to be delivered asynchronously. But asynchronously, from the point of view of the application, was not really asynchronous under the covers. In order to do this delivery, the MQJMS classes had to pull the queue manager and keep monitoring the queue for messages. So, in other words, a listener port, or an activation, or a listener port, I should say, would start a thread that would sit there basically doing MQ get over and over and over again in a loop. And all those MQ gets would add up in terms of CPU time, network overhead, and so forth. And then, of course, when one of those MQ gets finally found a message, it would get it for you and deliver it to your MDB. So from the point of view of the application, it all worked, but there was a lot of overhead under the covers. On slide 41, this is the new feature added by MQ version 7, truly asynchronous delivery. It's now possible to request that MQ notify your application when a message arrives that matches a selector, without your application sitting there and doing gets and gets and gets and gets over and over and over again. What's done is that for example, the MQJMS classes, they register a callback with the queue manager. And the queue manager is responsible for seeing the messages that are coming in and actually calling down to the JMS app and saying, here you go, here's a message that you wanted. MQI applications, native applications, can do the same as well. And a great advantage, frankly, for native MQ applications is if you're using this callback feature, when MQ delivers a message via callback, it has already placed the message in an appropriately sized buffer. So if you're used to using writing MQ native code where you choose a buffer size and if the message got truncated, then you just do the get over again with a larger buffer, you don't actually have to do that anymore if you don't want to. Another nice feature about this is with the asynchronous delivery, it's possible for native MQ apps to monitor more than one queue at a time. You can register a callback on one queue, on a topic, on another queue, and then as messages arrive which match, the queue manager will kick off your code and your application can process them. So both JMS and MQ can take advantage of this. And this means that things like listener ports and activation specifications, they don't have to do nearly as much work. There's much less CPU overhead. Let's go on now to slide 42, and we're nearly there. Legacy publish-subscribe. WebSphere MQ has provided PubSub for over a decade now. But until version 7, the publish-subscribe was always implemented using point-to-point messaging under the covers. The publish-subscribe was managed by a program called a broker, and that broker used a control queue, subscription queues, publication queues. It would monitor messages coming in on a subscription queue and fan them out to the publication queues. It all worked just fine, but of course it was implemented using queues. There was another caveat to our support. Any subscription made to the legacy broker was inherently durable. Now, in JMS, it's possible to create two types of subscriptions, a durable subscription, which means that even when your program ends, the subscription is still out there and messages are being sent to it, or a non-durable subscription, where one can receive messages from a topic, but when you close your connection or if your connection drops, your subscription goes away too. In order to handle the non-durable JMS subscriptions, MQ JMS classes had to have a lot of code to watch out for other applications that had lost a connection and whose durable subscription now needed to be cleaned up. So there was a lot of cleaning up after orphaned subscriptions. Let's go to slide 43. Version 7 of MQ now natively supports publish-subscribe using topic objects in addition to queue objects. Topics are first-class objects. Messages are published directly to topics, not to queues. Non-durable subscriptions are natively handled by the queue manager. And the broker, which handles all this work, is built into MQ even on ZOS. On ZOS, I believe that if you want to do PubSub, you had to get an external product like WebSphere Message Broker or WebSphere Event Broker. That's no longer so. Because topics are first-class objects in MQ, you can now administer them in the MQ Explorer, set security on particular topics and things like that. Publishing throughput is much improved. We don't have to worry about all those old queues, although they still do exist for backwards compatibility with old applications, if you have any JMS clients at version 6 or 5.3, for example. But even those older clients will see better performance with PubSub in version 7. So, slide number 44. Let me just summarize what we've talked about. WebSphere MQ has added many, many improvements to the core queue manager and to the JMS classes, specifically to make the JMS support just the premier JMS support we can offer. The JMS design, the classes, is greatly simplified. The packaging, now as a RAR file, allows one to install these classes in many different application servers quite easily. The features required by JMS are now natively supported by the queue manager and therefore are very quick. They don't have to be emulated by the JMS classes. The JMS classes and the Java classes themselves are much thinner. They've gone on a substantial diet. And for those of you who have a number of native MQ applications, your programs are not left out. You can now take advantage of most of these features. Some don't require any application changes. Others, you can now modify your applications to use the new features. And, of course, we have first-class publication and subscription support in the queue manager. There's more to it even than I put in this presentation, but time is short and the presentation is already long enough. As a quick example, it's now possible to send messages to MQ without waiting for an acknowledgement back. If you're generating non-persistent messages, you can very quickly just fire and forget. Another feature that's been added, which I haven't had time to cover here, is that we have new tracing and diagnostic features available in all of the JMS classes. It's much nicer in terms of getting a trace and being able to review that. That may not be as important for you as it is for us in support, but it will certainly help resolving any problems that do come up. A quick note, WebSphere MQ version 7 is going to be required on both the server and on the client side to take advantage of many of these new features. So even if you have, for example, the MQ JMS client installed, if you're talking with an older queue manager that doesn't understand the new MQI features, we're going to have to rely on some of the older code emulating some of those features. But if you get version 7 on both the server and on the client side, you should see a substantial improvement. Let's go now to slide 45. Here are a few resources which I hope you will find useful. Firstly, the WebSphere MQ version 7 library is at the first link. That includes the Online Information Center, downloadable PDF documents, if you prefer those. On that page, you'll find a link to the WebSphere MQ version 7 Features and Enhancements Red Book, which goes into many of the things that I've talked about here today and a few more as well. Third is the MQ support page. If you're looking for any maintenance, if you've run into a problem and wish to search on an error code, this is a good place to go too. And lastly are the WebSphere MQ support packs, where you can still download things like the MA88 classes. Believe it or not, they're actually still there because I think there's one platform that uses them, True64 Unix. But it goes out of support at the end of the month, so you've got about a week. So good luck with that. But there are a number of other support packs also out there providing different samples and a lot of other useful code. I encourage you to check it out. On slide 46 now, I will turn this over to Joseph, but here are additional WebSphere product resources, which, again, I hope you will find useful. Joseph?
Thanks again, Justin, for a great presentation. At this point, Sarah, we would like to open the line for questions.
And we have a question from Ralph Jones.
Hi. My question is concerning, we used to use the JMS admin function in version 6. We used the queue manager as a container. And we noticed that in version 7, first off, like the JMS admin GUI is not used anymore. So I guess it doesn't appear to be any support to use the queue manager as a JNDI repository. Is there a way to get around that, or there's some people to move?
That's a good question. Yeah, there's three components here. There's, first of all, the JMS admin command line tool, which is kind of like runmqsc to be able to define these JMS connection factories and other types of objects. Then I think you were using support pack, I believe it was MA0F, I might have the name wrong, but it was one that provided a GUI to the JMS admin. That has been replaced by the MQ Explorer. And I think the third thing you were referring to is that there was a support pack that allowed these objects that you defined to be stored as messages on an MQ queue. And I do remember that support pack, but I'm not sure if it has been withdrawn or what the plans are for it. I think that the WebSphere MQ Explorer, I don't recall that it has support for it, but I can look into that and find out for you.
That'd be great.
Thanks, Ross.
Thanks, man. Long time.
Yep.
We'll hear from Doug Giacoletto.
I may have missed it, but I didn't really see any reference to, like, MQ from the queue manager clustering standpoint in reference to this material.
It is possible for JMS applications to work with MQ clustered queues. However, the JMS application itself is probably not going to be aware that it's working with a cluster queue. For example, if you have a queue object, which refers to a queue that you happen to have in a cluster, and you produce messages to it, those messages may get fanned out through the cluster, but the JMS app won't know about it. In version 7 of MQ, we added topic objects. It's now possible to actually have clustered topic objects. Messages produced, published to a topic can now flow throughout your cluster as well. But I don't think there are any facilities in JMS itself which specifically contemplate the clustering in MQ. But it is certainly possible to work with clustered objects.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
We'll hear from Hakan Lantis.
Yeah, hello. I would like to hear if you have seen any usage of the other than the session auto acknowledge when creating a session.
We haven't seen too much of it. There are two other types of acknowledgement. There's auto acknowledge. And most, I will say, of the JMS activity we see these days is in the context of an application server. And with auto-acknowledge, that's the container that takes care of doing all the acknowledgement for you. The other types of acknowledgement modes are client-acknowledge, which I don't think can be done in a container. It's going to be disallowed. But in a standalone JVM, there's a acknowledge method that the client code would have to do for each message received. And then the other type is DUPS OK acknowledge, where multiple messages are retrieved at once, and if something goes wrong, then they all get rolled back, and therefore they may get redelivered and reprocessed more than once. I think once or twice I may have seen DUPS OK acknowledge be used, but it's fairly unusual. It seems that most of the patterns people are using is the auto acknowledge.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, you're welcome.
Our next question will come from Robert Standish.
Hi. I'd like to follow up a little bit on the cluster question that the gentleman asked a moment ago. We're having an issue where we're writing to an alias queue that resolves to a clustered queue.
Okay.
And the JMS application seems to be trying to resolve the base queue and not just, you know, basically put the message to the alias queue and let the queue manager fan it out across the cluster. And you had made a comment that the JMS isn't cluster aware, if you will. So I don't know. Is this an issue with JMS with using alias queues getting into a cluster, or?
Well, The only thing that I can recall seeing in the past, I think I remember seeing a case where if an alias queue filled in the queue manager name was filled in, it would defeat the clustering algorithm in MQ because the alias would say, oh, yes, this alias is to a particular queue on this queue manager, rather than leaving the queue manager name blank. And if the queue manager name were blank, then MQ would say, oh, okay, well, I can use any queue manager. I can fan this out across the cluster. So there may be one or two gotchas in terms of the JNDI object definitions, but the actual JMS application is still unaware that it's actually dealing with a cluster queue. But it's possible that there may be a configuration thing. I know we have seen one or two issues on that side.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question will come from Kavita Kasi.
Hi. How can we customize the queues for different subscribers?
Can you elaborate on that question a bit more?
Sure. We have multiple subscribers to a particular topic, and we wanted each of the subscribers to go, the messages for those subscribers to go to a different queue with respect to the MQ. So is that possible from a JMS coding standpoint?
It is. I think it can even be done with the administered objects. If I'm not mistaken, there is a model queue that is used to create a temporary queue. So when you subscribe to a topic, you get a temporary queue, and your publications will go there and be retrieved by that. I believe it is possible to change the name of the queue, the format of the naming of that. But it's been a little while since I looked at that.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Sure.
Our next question will come from Charles Clark.
Thanks very much for the presentation. When moving to WebSphere MQ 7.0, it seems that close coordination is going to be required between the WebSphere MQ administrators, the WebSphere application server administrators, and the Java programmers. Is that a true statement?
There will need to be some coordination. It should be possible. I'm thinking of two different upgrade scenarios. One is where you have, say, WebSphere 6.1 and MQ6, and you upgrade MQ first. That should not require any particular problems for the WebSphere administrators. If you do the upgrade in the opposite direction, if you upgrade WebSphere to, say, version 7, and you have an older version of MQ,
right.
In that particular case, you know, I think that it still should be fine. MQ will include its own backwards compatibility. So if you upgrade one and not the other, it should still work. What the JMS classes do in MQ version 7 is we have that new architecture that I laid out with this new Java MQI and the rest of it. But essentially included in the version 7 classes is a updated version of the old version 6 classes, MQ version 6, so that even if you upgrade WebSphere first and you're using the RAR file in the V7 JMS classes, under the covers they'll talk the version 6 lingo to older queue managers. So I think that you could actually upgrade either one first without too much difficulty or admin action required by the other servers. As far as the JMS programmers themselves, things should be backwards compatible such that, and if an application worked before, it will continue to work unchanged, even if, well, maybe one caveat. If you're writing an MDB and you've configured your MDB to be deployed against an activation spec, at some point you'll need to modify your MDB so that it's going to be deployed against an activation spec rather than a listener port. Sorry, I should have said listener port earlier. So that is a change required for any applications, including MDBs, that switch from listener ports to activation specs. But that can even be done after you upgrade to WebSphere version 7.
That's very helpful.
Yeah, the one thing I'm aware of that could be a little bit of a problem, if you are trying to deploy newer EJBs, like EJB 3.0, and you run to write an MDB to the 3.0 spec, you're not going to be able to do it, I don't think, for WebSphere MQ in WebSphere version 6 or 6.1. You would need WebSphere version 7 with the RAR packaging of MQ.
Understood.
Our next question will come from Mathu Kumar Alagat.
Yeah. Hi, Justin. I just wanted to know on the callback feature that you were talking about, is that just available in the Java classes, or is it a common feature that has been brought in MQ7?
It's a common feature. So you can do that in base native MQ applications, not even Java applications. You could do callbacks in C or COBOL or anything like that.
Okay. So where do I find the information related to that? Like, mm-hmm. Is there any link that I can get it?
Yeah, on the WebSphere resources page, one of the last ones in the presentation, there's a link to the MQ library. In the MQ library, there's a book that talks about changes in MQ version 7, but specifically there are two books. One is called the Application Programming Guide, and that's probably the first book that you want to look at. That one describes how to do those callbacks in languages like C or COBOL, and that's definitely going to be the place to look. So it's particularly useful if you have applications that do anything like, well, gee, we want to monitor these two queues for messages and do something with them. Using the existing MQI in version 6, you had to, you know, look on one queue, maybe wait for a little while, then look on the other queue and keep going back and forth. And now it's much easier to do that with much less CPU overhead.
Yeah, like in our project, like we are continuously monitoring the queues and probing them for the messages whether it's reached the queue or not. So, is there any support pack or kind of stuff like that to which implements this callback feature in version 6?
Oh, there's nothing for version 6. It's required internal changes to the queue manager. There are for version 7. There are sample programs that demonstrate how to do that. And I think the Application Programming Guide has an appendix which lists the sample programs and what they demonstrate, but there is one for that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question will come from Jose Padilla.
Hello. I probably missed this part. I know you mentioned something about WebSphere version 7, the application server, where there's a migration process for the listener port to make it an activation specification server. Can you just recap on this a little bit more?
Sure. The listener ports in the WebSphere application server were, in order to get to them, you had to go through quite a different path than almost everything else. You had to go into these servers, click on your particular server name. On the right-hand side of the panel, you have to scroll down, and there would be a message listener service. And finally, then you could see your listener ports. And they have a connection factory and a destination and some other details like how many MDBs can run in parallel. Now in WebSphere version 7, if you go and look at a listener port, you'll actually see a button that you can press to say, I want to run the wizard to create an activation spec out of this listener port. I believe that the wizard leaves your listener port in place. So by doing so, you're not going to screw up any applications that are actually running and using the thing, but it will create the new object from the listener port for you.
Thanks.
Sure.
And we have no further questions.
Thank you, Sarah. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.